Inside the CIA by Ronald Kessler. This book is read by Edward Lewis. Acknowledgements. My editor, Paul D. McCarthy of Pocket Books, came up with the idea for this book, provided strong encouragement throughout the project, guided me through difficult decisions about organization, and brilliantly edited the manuscript. An editor with his range of talents is rare. I owe him a tremendous debt. In the early stages, people who were particularly helpful were Colonel Russell J. Bowen, Dr. Lee S. Hochens, David D. Whipple, the late John A. Bross, and several others who cannot be named. As explained in the author's note, once the book was well underway, William H. Webster, then Director of Central Intelligence, gave approval for limited CIA cooperation, the first time the CIA has cooperated on a book about the agency. He and Joseph R. Detrani, E. Peter Ernest, and Gwen Cohen of the CIA Public Affairs Office are due special thanks. A number of former employees of each CIA directorate, of the Office of the Director of Central Intelligence, and of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, read portions of the manuscript. While some cannot be named, they include Herbert F. Saunders, Robert R. Simmons, Nancy D. McGregor, John B. Bellinger, Russell J. Broomer, and Roland Inlow. The fact that they read portions of the book does not mean that they agree with everything in it. However, by investing their time and energy, they helped to make it a richer and more accurate book. My wife, Pamela Kessler, applied her sharp editing eye to the manuscript and improved the quality of the book. My friend Daniel M. Clements also read the manuscript and came up with insightful advice on themes and organization. By being both friend and professional colleague, Pam Kessler did more than anyone to make this book a reality. My children, Greg V. Kessler and Rachel Kessler, now pursuing their own careers, have been a source of pride that helped sustain me. The book would never have been written without the valuable time devoted to it by those who consented to be interviewed. While all of them cannot be named, those who were interviewed or who helped in other ways include John J. T. Altizer, Moria Arsenault, John P. Austin, Dr. William Bader, William M. Baker, Howard T. Bain, Isabella Bates, Sean Beeney, David W. Beelan, Bester T. Bell, John B. Bellinger III, Abram Bergson, Igor Berman, Richard M. Bissell Jr., Nancy H. Blanchett, Sylvia Blanchett, Lane Bonner, Colonel Russell J. Bowen, the late John A. Bross, Russell J. Broomer, Dino A. Brugioni, Coralie Marcus Bryant, Donald F. Burton, and Plato Cacheris, Vincent M. Canestraro, Leo Carl, Francis D. Carter, Douglas Cater, David Chachavadze, Walter M. Clark, John Clark, Dr. Ray S. Klein, Gwen Cohen, William E. Colby, George C. Constantinides, Elizabeth M. Cook, Alexandra Costa, Robert T. Crowley, James Curry, Kenneth E. de Graffenried, Joseph R. Detrani, John T. Downey, E. Peter Ernest, Walter N. Elder, Stephen Engelberg, Andrew T. Falkowitz, David E. Faulkner, Richard G. Fechteau, Horace Z. Feldman, and Charles Fenovesi. Harry E. Fitzwater, Dr. Harold P. Ford, Gary E. Foster, Thomas B. Fricke, Graham E. Fuller, Robert M. Gates, Claire E. George, Kathy Gill, Lieutenant General Daniel O. Graham, John K. Greeney, James W. Greenleaf, Howard W. Gutman, Samuel Halpern, Howard P. Hart, William T. Hassler, Richard Helms, Alan Bruce Hemmings, Herbert E. Hettu, William Hood, Eugene J. Horan, John B. Hodes, Dr. Lee S. Hochens, Lawrence R. Houston, Colonel David L. Huxall, and Roland Inlow. Admiral Bobby R. Inman, Donald F. B. Jameson, Louise R. Lisa Jameson, F. Peter Jessup, Paul Joyle, D. Barry Kelly, Charles M. Kerr, Richard J. Kerr, William Kusowitz, Conrad E. Legue, George V. Lauder, William T. Lee, Stanislav Levchenko, Arthur C. Lundahl, Douglas S. Macall II, Henry C. Macall, Andrew W. Marshall, John L. Martin, Linda McCarthy, Representative Dave McCurdy, Nancy D. McGregor, John N. McMahon, Clayton E. McManaway Jr., and Ann Medinger. Cord Meyer, Herbert E. Meyer, William G. Miller, Judge William H. Orrick, Philip A. Parker, Thomas Polgar, Edward W. Proctor, Oliver Buck Revell, Juan Antonio Meña Rodriguez, Stephen Rosefield, Henry S. Rowan, Jim Sanborn, Richard Sanza, Herbert F. Saunders, Daniel F. Sheehan, Joe Shimone, Rear Admiral Donald M. Mack Showers, Representative Bud Schuster, Representative Robert R. Simmons, Russell Jack Smith, L. Britt Snyder, Bruce Soley, Mary Spaeth, Judge Stanley Sporkin, Saul Stern, General Richard G. Stilwell, Philip Stoddard, Lawrence B. Sultz, John E. Taylor, and Eric Tobias. Admiral Stansfield Turner, Robert N. Waluski, John S. Warner, Doris Webb, Linda Jo Webster, William H. Webster, David D. Whipple, John Wyant, Donald Wortman, F. Mark Wyatt, Dr. Keith R. Yamamoto, Roger S. Young, and Norman A. Zagrossi. They have my gratitude. Introduction. For William H. Webster, the day began routinely enough. A heavily armed Central Intelligence Agency car, equipped with 3 telephones, picked him up at his home in Bethesda, Maryland, and drove him to the White House. Just before 8 a.m., he met with President Bush to present the President's Daily Brief, a top-secret document that contains the most sensitive secrets in Washington. At 8:30 a.m., Webster arrived at Langley in McLean, Virginia, taking his private elevator to his 7th-floor suite of gray-carpeted offices. At 10 a.m., Webster met with John L. Helgerson, the Central Intelligence Agency's Deputy Director for Intelligence. It was Helgerson's job to make sense of all the agency's reports from human spies, billion-dollar satellites, and eavesdroppers on communications, and to predict the most likely course of events. This was one of their regular meetings, but they spent most of their time talking about the Iraqi threat to Kuwait. Helgerson warned that, based on the latest information, Saddam Hussein would most likely invade Kuwait within a matter of days. The only question was how much of Kuwait he would take and whether he would go on to invade Saudi Arabia. Webster later conferred with Richard J. Kerr, the Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, and with Richard F. Stoltz, the Deputy Director for Operations. Stoltz had the job of directing the agency's human spy operations, along with covert action. That was the area that had gotten the CIA into so much trouble, for example in the abortive invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, and more recently in the Iran-Contra affair. At 12:30 p.m., Webster had lunch with Donald Graham, publisher of the Washington Post, in the director's dining room. He then met with officials from the CIA's National Collection Division. Among other things, the division, now merged into a new Domestic Resources Division, interviews businessmen and other travelers after they return from overseas trips. The officials told Webster that they were starting to obtain plans for Iraqi chemical and biological weapons factories from the companies that had built the plants. Just after 6:30 p.m., Webster took the elevator back to the CIA's underground garage, where his CIA car and a chase car were waiting to return him to his red brick home on a secluded street off Bradley Boulevard. During the day, the office of security guards who drove him back and forth remained in a glass-enclosed cubicle lined with closed-circuit television monitors across from his office. Technicians from the Office of Security swept his office for bugs every few months and installed special devices on his window panes to prevent possible KGB eavesdropping using laser beams. At first, Webster had refused to allow the security guards to stay in his home at night. Later, he had relented. In any case, the house was protected by alarms that would bring CIA guards, FBI agents, and Montgomery County police officers running. Webster had just fed a biscuit to his basset hound, Babs, when the white phone in his study rang. The phone was a direct, secure link to the White House. It was 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday, August 1, 1990. Brent Scowcroft, the President's Assistant for National Affairs, was on the other end. Scowcroft had been getting scattered, unconfirmed reports that Iraqi forces might be surging over the Kuwaiti border. Scowcroft wanted to know what else Webster knew about it. Ever since November 1989, the CIA had been warning in top-secret reports that Saddam Hussein had aggressive intentions and wanted to dominate the Middle East. But the CIA predicted it would take 3 years before the Iraqi leader recovered enough from the costs of the Iran-Iraq war to take action. On July 23, 1990, the CIA reported that Saddam Hussein was moving troops toward Kuwait and that an invasion was possible. A few hours before Scowcroft called Webster, CIA Deputy Director Kerr had told the State Department, based on intercepted communications, that an invasion would occur within the next 24 hours. Webster told Scowcroft he would find out what was new and get back to him. He called the CIA's operations office, a communications center at Langley that is manned 24 hours a day. The center had gotten the same reports. Webster called Scowcroft back and told him he knew nothing further. By 8 that evening, the invasion had begun, setting into motion a chain of events that would culminate with Iraq's defeat by American and Allied forces by February 27, 1991. In the intervening months, the CIA would generate most of the intelligence needed to evaluate Saddam Hussein's intentions and then to prosecute the war. Before the war began on January 16, 1991, the agency would send some 500 reports to the White House on the effect of economic sanctions against Iraq, on Saddam Hussein's preparations for war, and on the Iraqi leader's character and personality. Through Webster's control of the National Reconnaissance Office committee that assigns satellite coverage, the CIA would position satellites over the Middle East so that the military could see their targets on television monitors in real time. The agency would obtain the engineering and architectural plans of key Iraqi targets. It would assess Iraqi troop strength and morale. It would predict in the president's daily brief that Saddam Hussein would unleash an oil spill on the Persian Gulf and that he would use other scorched-earth tactics before withdrawing from Kuwait. The CIA would coordinate propaganda efforts such as distribution of leaflets and establishment of a clandestine radio station urging Iraqi soldiers to surrender. And it would help to free some of the Americans taken hostage by Saddam Hussein in the early stages of the conflict. While the CIA would make some mistakes, such as overestimating the number of Iraqi troops in Kuwait, its record overall during the Persian Gulf War would be impressive. By midnight, Webster was back behind his mahogany desk in his office at the CIA, surrounded by 4 telephones, 6 inboxes, and 15 direct hotlines to the CIA's senior officials. On his walls were dozens of mementos of his career as a lawyer, judge, and director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and then the CIA. A photo of Webster with President Bush and 2 of Millie's puppies romping on the White House lawn. A photo of Webster giving President Reagan a pistol that could be used to pull off riding boots. A copy of a painting of President Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation, given to Webster, a Civil War buff, by the Society of Former Special Agents of the FBI. At 66, Webster had an ageless face, thin lips, and a high forehead. His slightly graying black hair was always immaculately combed. He was a study in contrasts, an austere man who liked to be called judge to emphasize his separation from the agency and the abuses that had occurred in the past, who surrounded himself with brilliant young lawyers as if he were still in his judge's chambers, and who wore Brooks Brothers suits, monogrammed button-down shirts, and gold tie clips. At the same time, Webster was then dating, and would soon marry, Linda Jo Clugston, a highly attractive 34-year-old blonde who was director of sales and marketing at the Watergate Hotel in Washington. Webster had dated a number of attractive women, from tennis pro Kathy Kemper to syndicated columnist Karen Feld, since the death of his wife Drusilla in 1984. Webster was a highly competitive tennis player who recognized that tennis diplomacy could win more support in Washington than the most eloquent testimony before congressional oversight committees. He had played with everyone from George Bush, when Bush was vice president, to Zsa Zsa Gabor. Despite his stern demeanor, Webster had a sense of humor, occasionally signing letters to friends 0014, doubling James Bond's code number because he was the 14th director of Central Intelligence. One of Webster's most treasured possessions, given to him by an assistant at the FBI, was a 2-foot-high brown bear dressed in judicial robes, tennis shoes, an FBI t-shirt, and pinstriped pants, its hands clutching a tennis racket. As he prepared to meet representatives of Middle East intelligence services to exchange views at 1 a.m. on August 2nd, Webster was feeling good about the CIA and the role it played. To be sure, he still found some offices lacking. But when he first became director of Central Intelligence on May 26, 1987, he was shocked to find that agency officials on more than one occasion had failed to tell him the truth. Not that they lied outright, they were too smart for that. but by telling only half the story, by answering questions precisely, by not addressing the real intent of Webster's questions, they had misled him, just as some CIA officers had misled the agency's Inspector General and the presidentially appointed Tower Commission when they had investigated the CIA's role in the Iran-Contra affair. Moreover, Webster had found that the CIA's methods for making decisions were woefully inadequate. Plans for undertaking covert action were approved rather informally, and the hard questions were often not addressed. What would happen if it became public? Would it make sense to the American people? Does it conform with American law? Above all, Webster was a lawyer, a man who wanted facts to be backed up and procedures to be followed. Too often he found that when he asked the source of a statement, the answer was, "Johnny Smith on the third floor told me." As a judge, first on the district court level and then on the appeals court level, his opinions had been replete with citations. He wanted the same documentation to back up reports at the CIA. Webster found the attitude of some CIA officials about Congress and the congressional oversight process infuriating. "They're not entitled to know that. We don't have to tell them that," some of them said. In briefing books presented to him before he testified on Capitol Hill, CIA officials prepared expected questions with suggested answers. Repeatedly, Webster found the answers did not tell the whole truth. At least in part, the attitude was a holdover from Webster's predecessor, William J. Casey, who had developed non-responsiveness to oversight into an art form. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence had even built a special amplifying system into its bug-proof hearing room in an effort to make Casey's muttering intelligible. What the senators did not realize was that when he wanted to be understood, Casey spoke as clearly as John F. Kennedy. That kind of arrogance had gotten the agency involved in the Iran-Contra mess in the first place. Not long after Webster took over the agency in 1987, stories began appearing in the press that he was about to be replaced. Even though Bush had asked Webster to continue to head the agency after Bush became president, the stories persisted, saying he was not doing a good job, that Bush was dissatisfied with him, that he spent all his time playing tennis, and that he would not last another month. The fact that Webster remained in office years after the stories had appeared did not prevent new ones from being published. Meanwhile, rumors circulated that the CIA was drifting, that it had become bloated by bureaucrats, that morale was bad, that it had stopped doing anything worthwhile. Clearly, some of the people around Bush were unhappy with Webster. He was a lawyer and a former judge who had been brought in to impose order on the CIA. He was not a foreign policy expert and felt uncomfortable posing as one. But Bush had no problems with him, and each time one of the stories appeared, Bush called Webster on the phone, dropped him a note, or took him aside after their almost daily morning meetings. The president would crack some joke about the media and assure him that he was fully satisfied with his performance and wanted him to stay on. Several times Webster offered to resign, and Bush had insisted that he remain. The disparity between the public perception and the reality could be a metaphor for the CIA itself, for no agency of government is so little understood or so misunderstood. That, of course, is the way the founders of the agency had wanted it. Men such as William J. Wild Bill Donovan, Alan W. Dulles, John A. McCone, and Richard Helms. They were the men who kept the secrets and were proud of it. They saw no conflict in running a secret intelligence organization within a free society. Nor did they see any reason to let the rest of America know what they were doing. They asked only, as Helms asked the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 1971, to take it in part on faith that "we too are honorable men devoted to her, the nation's, service." Even the most devastating charges, from accusations of drug running to murder, were met by a stoic, some would say masochistic, "no comment." Aided and abetted by a Congress that shirked its oversight duties, the company, as it was called in its early days, was answerable only to the president. It had a can-do spirit, a willingness to tackle any problem, in an era when the United States legitimately felt threatened by the advancing armies of the Soviet Union and the Cold War. Then came Watergate and Vietnam, when the government lied about the progress of the war and President Nixon covered up White House involvement in the break-in at Democratic National Committee headquarters. When Seymour Hersh of the New York Times broke the story in December 1974 that the CIA had violated its charter by spying on Americans who were against the war, Congress could no longer look the other way. In 1975, a committee headed by the late Senator Frank Church, an Idaho Democrat, began an investigation that would profoundly alter the way the CIA did business. The committee and a President's Commission, chaired by Vice President Nelson A. Rockefeller, found that the CIA for 20 years had illegally intercepted and opened mail between the United States and the Soviet bloc, had kept dossiers on thousands of American citizens, and indexed the names of 300,000 American citizens who had no connection with espionage, had infiltrated dissident groups in the Washington, D.C. area, had experimented with LSD on unsuspecting Americans, leading to one suicide, and had unsuccessfully attempted to kill at least 5 foreign leaders, including Cuban Premier Fidel Castro. Most of these actions had been approved, if not ordered, by the presidents at the time. Most were known to cabinet officers as well, including attorneys general. Most of the abuses had stopped by the time they were exposed, and nearly all the abuses had been uncovered by the CIA itself. James R. Schlesinger, as Director of Central Intelligence, had ordered CIA employees in 1973 to report any activities that might be outside the legislative charter of this agency. The result was the Family Jewels, 693 pages of single-spaced documents that William E. Colby brought to the attention of Congress after he had been nominated as CIA director. Once he became Director of Central Intelligence, Colby confirmed for Hirsch the basic points of his story, giving the Times greater confidence about running it. To be sure, the agency reflected the prevailing norms. The FBI performed illegal break-ins and wiretaps, police departments routinely brutalized blacks, and trustees of non-profit hospitals kept millions of dollars of hospital funds in interest-free accounts at banks where they were officers. But that was no excuse. The abuses were not only improper and illegal, they betrayed a lack of understanding of what America was all about. For what was the CIA for if not to help preserve American freedoms? Aside from their impropriety, many of the abuses betrayed a dismaying lack of competence. The CIA had enlisted the Mafia to assassinate Castro, which was not only outrageous, but stupid. And the agency plotted to humiliate Castro with his own people by trying to get his beard to fall off, something that only someone whose level of maturity had not advanced beyond kindergarten could have dreamed up. The attempts to kill Castro were absurd, just absurd, said John N. McMahon, Deputy Director of Central Intelligence under Casey. I guess we're embarrassed because it's like the gang that couldn't shoot straight. But that's Bush League. The Church hearings led to tighter control of covert action by Congress and establishment of permanent intelligence committees to oversee the CIA and related agencies in 1976 and 1977. For most Americans, this was the last glimpse they would have of the CIA and what it does. CIA officers repeated their catechism. Our failures are publicized. Our successes are not. The old saw happened to be correct. Like a shimmering oasis, the agency is usually not what it seems to be. Even something as basic as the CIA's complement of employees is routinely understated in the press as 16,000. The true number, which is classified, is 22,000, not including 4,000 contract and part-time employees. To find out what the CIA is really like and how CIA officers think and act, one must probe into each of the agency's 5 components, 4 directorates and the Office of the Director of Central Intelligence. For each directorate has its own mission, its own culture and mores. Each reports to the Director of Central Intelligence, DCI, only grudgingly, fearful that its own turf will be infringed upon or that its secrets will be shared with the other directorates. Like opposing sports teams, each component is in silent competition with the others, certain that its work is most important, vying for available funds, attention, and status. It is the Directorate of Operations that does the human spying. Operations refers to covert operations. The Directorate of Science and Technology uses satellites and other technical means to spy. It also conducts research into technological innovations. The name of the directorate implies that it collects intelligence through technical means. The Directorate of Intelligence brings together all the available information, 80% of it from overt sources such as publications, and analyzes it. The information is used to prepare memos and estimates that go to the president. The Directorate of Administration holds it all together by providing computers, security, communications, and the like. The Directorate of Science and Technology feels that it collects as much intelligence and therefore is as important as the Directorate of Operations, Herbert F. Saunders, a former CIA officer, said. On the other hand, the Directorate of Operations, always cocky, says, "We got all the action. We make the world go around. Satellites can't tell you what people are going to do." The logistics people in the Directorate of Administration say, "Without vehicles, you guys couldn't get anything done." The security people say, "Without us, you'd have no secrets." The analytical people in the Directorate of Intelligence think that what it all comes down to is their work, the analysis, publication, and delivery to the consumer. And they have a point, too, Saunders said. They say that's the name of the game, to bring information to the country's leaders to let them make decisions. Even within each directorate, there are separate components with their own unique character. The Office of Technical Service within the Directorate of Science and Technology, which provides lockpickers, installs bugging devices, and makes spy equipment ranging from disguises and speech-altering devices to papers used for secret writing. The Office of Security within the Directorate of Administration, which participates in espionage investigations with the FBI and sweeps the CIA's offices for electronic bugs. The Office of Financial Management within the same directorate, which not only issues paychecks but launders money for clandestine operations. The Office of Logistics, also within administration, which arranges for overseas homes for CIA officers and also buys weapons for use in faraway wars. The Counter-Narcotics Center, within the Directorate of Intelligence, which employs satellites to spot fields planted with coca plants and ships laden with cocaine. And the Counter-Terrorism Center, which traces terrorists' bank accounts using satellites that intercept electronic bank transfers. Besides an original and a new building at its headquarters on Dolly Madison Boulevard in McLean, Virginia, the CIA has its own printing plant on the compound that turns out routine classified documents, as well as the President's daily brief, the top-secret document presented to the President every morning. The document, usually 8 to 9 pages, comes off the press at 6 a.m. A double-wrapped copy is delivered to the director's home so he can read it on the way to the White House. A CIA briefer gives a second copy to the President around 8 a.m. Hidden in the basement of the new building is another secret printing plant that prints forged documents, phony birth certificates, foreign passports, and driver's licenses for use in the CIA's clandestine work. The plant also prints books and other publications in foreign languages to be distributed abroad, and leaflets to be dropped on countries such as Iraq for their propaganda value. The agency maintains 22 other offices throughout the Washington area. One building houses the CIA's Foreign Broadcast Information Service, which monitors and translates broadcasts throughout the world, including television programs in 47 countries. Other offices throughout Washington are leased through phony companies and used to recruit KGB officers to turn on their own country and spy for the United States. Still another building in Roslyn, Virginia, is used by the CIA to recruit the agency's own spies, the staff officers who will live overseas undercover, and recruit agencies who will risk their lives to help the U.S. For it is the CIA's role to collect foreign intelligence, not to collect information on the U.S., and for that it maintains stations in 130 countries of the world. If the CIA is fascinating, it is also secretive, sometimes foolishly so. In late 1990, the members of the CIA's Employee Activity Association decided that the group's store on the ground floor of CIA headquarters in McLean should sell CIA commemorative mugs, T-shirts, and baseball hats. They pointed out that Cassell's Sports and Awards, a mile and a half away, did a booming business in the souvenirs. Why shouldn't CIA employees be able to buy the mugs at headquarters? Each of the powers at the CIA weighed in with his views. The Deputy Director for Administration, Raymond Hufstetler, opposed the mugs. The CIA's effectiveness depended on keeping a low profile. How could undercover officers take home CIA hats and shirts for their kids? Richard Kerr, the agency's deputy director, had the same reservations. It went against the CIA's grain to advertise itself, he argued. Others said undercover officers should not be working for the CIA if they were dumb enough to take home CIA mementos. It was an example of CIA paranoia. Anyone could buy the items in the center of McLean, Virginia. Why all the fuss? the issue made its way up to what is known as the front office, where William Webster decided against selling the mugs. Webster was puzzled by the controversy. Covert employees were not supposed to take such items home anyway, and it was difficult for him to understand how CIA officers could be so insistent on remaining unseen. But Webster was also sensitive to tradition. If selling memorabilia went against past practice, it was not worth making an issue of it. As this vignette illustrates, the CIA would like to remain as invisible as a pane of glass. Practically everything that goes on at the agency is classified. Even newspaper clippings have been stamped secret. Employees must sign pledges when they begin and leave employment that anything they write about their work will be submitted first to CIA censors. Polygraph tests that are supposed to be conducted every 5 years act as a deterrent against secrets being revealed. Every employee accepts this code of silence, a pact that prohibits employees from telling even spouses what they are doing in any detail. It is a code that pervades the CIA's environment, from the front entrance, where no signs proclaim that this is the fabled agency, to a building at the rear of the CIA's 258-acre compound, where top-secret documents that are no longer of value are shredded and treated with chemicals to remove any writing. The CIA is a relatively new agency, established in 1947. Because the legislation that set it up gave it little guidance, the agency has had to invent itself along the way. There have been many false starts and many mistakes. Today, the CIA is a mature organization, one that is very different from the agency of just 15 years ago. Despite the breakup of the Soviet Union, the CIA's mission of finding out what potential adversaries are doing remains critically important, as illustrated by the agency's role in the events leading up to the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, and America's subsequent war against Iraq. To this day, the Russian Republic continues to spy on the U.S., and the U.S., through the CIA, continues to spy on the Russian Republic. Despite its importance, the CIA, to most Americans, remains a perplexing cipher. To some, it represents a threat to American freedoms. To others, it is a protector of those same freedoms. Both glorified and vilified throughout the world, it is more closely identified with the United States than is any other institution. To separate myth from reality, one must examine each of the agency's parts. For the modern CIA is not so much a single entity as a mosaic, each square filled with secrets. Part 1. The Directorate of Operations. Chapter 1. The Real CIA. When most people think of the CIA, they think of the Directorate of Operations, the spy side of the house that is also known as the clandestine service. Consisting of some 5,000 of the CIA's 22,000 full-time employees, the Directorate of Operations is the most secretive CIA component, and the proudest, the one that takes the greatest risks, and the one that gets the CIA into the most trouble. Given its mission, this is understandable. The Directorate of Operations commits espionage in other countries, seeking out information that is usually classified. By definition, it is the job of this directorate to break the laws of other countries. In that respect, the directorate's mission differs from that of the State Department, which seeks information that is overt and can therefore be obtained legally. Moreover, it is the Directorate of Operations that undertakes covert action, attempts to influence or overthrow foreign governments or political parties or leaders through secret funding, training, paramilitary operations, and propaganda. Like the CIA's other directorates, the Directorate of Operations is chauvinistic about its work, convinced that its role is the most important one. The covert side is the real CIA, a former CIA operations officer said. The DS&T, Directorate of Science and Technology, people are relatively new and work in research. The DI, Directorate of Intelligence, people are paper pushers. In my experience, the most important thing in intelligence is people, Thomas Polgar, a former CIA officer, said. There is no substitute for having your own reporting sources in the field who can tell you what is going on. People decide to join the clandestine side of the house for any number of reasons. The ones given by David D. Whipple, a former chief of station in Finland, Cambodia, Portugal, Switzerland, and the former Belgian Congo, are as representative as any. It suited my spirit of adventure. I would be dedicating myself to one thing, The idea of living abroad in a very challenging situation appealed to me. As a youngster, I had a desire to experience as many things as I could before I die, Whipple said. Patriotism was involved. When you give something to your country, you become more attached to your country. When the CIA was started, Ivy League graduates tended to fill the top jobs. William J. Donovan, the director of the Office of Strategic Services, was a lawyer who had graduated from Columbia College and Columbia University Law School. As far back as George Washington, government officials have recruited spies from among people they know. Donovan was no different. Those he knew were the Eastern establishment. Many of the same people formed the nucleus of the CIA. But the CIA was never primarily a cloister of the Ivy League. Walter Bedell Smith, director of Central Intelligence from 1950 to 1953, never graduated from college. I went around the table at the morning meeting with 12 senior people of the agency and I said, "Let's get this straight. How many of you are Ivy League?" William Colby, director of Central Intelligence from 1973 to 1976, recalled. There were three. Two hadn't gone to college. Before being sent to spy overseas, CIA operations officers, known colloquially as spies, are trained at Camp Peary, the legendary center outside Williamsburg, Virginia, whose existence is still supposed to be a secret. There, members of the Career Trainee Program are given courses in the detection of explosives, surveillance and counter-surveillance, how to write reports, how to shoot a variety of weapons, and how to run counter-terrorism, counter-narcotics, and paramilitary operations. Most important, they are taught how to recruit and run agents, the foreign nationals who provide CIA officers with secret information. In the spy business, the distinction between officers and agents is crucial. The CIA officers are staff employees who are patriots in their own country. The agents are the people recruited by the CIA officers to betray their own countries. Invariably, the press mixes up the two, calling anyone who works for the CIA an agent. Paramilitary training is conducted at Harvey Point, North Carolina, and in such places as Panama or the mountains of Arizona, where officers must hike through snake-infested swamps or freeze during overnight treks. Each year, the CIA bangs up hundreds of old cars in a defensive driving course that teaches officers what to do if terrorists set up blockades on the road. The training and running agents is designed not only to teach officers tradecraft, but also to make them think. For example, in one role-playing exercise, a CIA employee pretending to be an agent arranged to meet a female trainee in a movie theater. During the movie, he placed his hands on her dress and tried to kiss her. The female officer objected. The man persisted. She finally got up and left. A subsequent critique criticized her because she had made no plans to get in touch with the agent again. Moreover, officers are not supposed to meet agents in a movie theater. It's dark and an officer cannot take notes. In another exercise, the CIA trainees kidnap other trainees and take them to a secret location to get them to break down and confess to being CIA officers. "You are in your apartment at 2 a.m., a former operations officer said. "Someone knocks on your door. You are in your pajamas. Three or four big guys grab you and wrap you in a sheet, put you in a van, take you to a site near National Airport, put you in a plane, and fly you off." The trainee is untied in a cell and interrogated. Unknown to him, the questioning is done by other trainees undergoing their final exercise. Days go by and the trainee is given little sleep. He is allowed out of his cell only to take a cold shower. Some trainees become distraught, break down, and confess they work for the CIA. Others do not. Nothing happens to those who confess. It's just a training exercise. CIA officers are taught that faced with torture, they will eventually spill the beans anyway. Including assignments to different directorates to gain experience, the training takes a year. Usually, CIA operations officers work under government cover. Most often, they pose as State Department officers. They may also masquerade as military officers or civilians or as other government employees. They never use the Peace Corps as a cover. In most cases, CIA officers have diplomatic immunity, meaning that if one of them is caught spying, he can only be declared persona non grata and expelled by a foreign government. However, host governments often rough them up before releasing them, claiming they were not aware they had diplomatic immunity. The CIA also fields several hundred operations officers who work under commercial cover, meaning they pose as entrepreneurs or employees of private companies. Called non-official cover, this is a far riskier assignment than working under government cover, since CIA officers without diplomatic immunity can be arrested and imprisoned for spying. It is also far more expensive to maintain a CIA officer in this capacity. While they usually use their real names, their true affiliations are concealed. Elaborate cover stories must be devised to establish their false backgrounds. The top officer of a company knows they are with the CIA. Depending on the size of the company, one or two others may know their true identity. Ideally, the CIA officer is the company's only representative in a given geographic area. That way, he has no supervisors who are aware of what the officer is doing each day. Sometimes, CIA officers under commercial cover do so well in their jobs that the companies offer them real jobs at double what the CIA was paying. Decades ago, CIA officers under commercial cover were used to spot and recruit agents. That was far too risky and not always necessary. Today, they are used more to communicate with agents who have already been recruited, particularly sensitive ones who should not be handled by anyone connected with the local embassy. It's a program that has never been enthusiastically supported, a former operations officer said. You go to the trouble of getting someone into a company and it costs a lot of extra money. Only in the last 20 years has there been a shift to using them for sensitive people who cannot have contact with Americans. Besides staff employees, the CIA maintains contract employees, who are typically employed for 2 years with salary and benefits. They may be hired to perform specific tasks, such as undertaking paramilitary activities. Together with part-time employees, the CIA has 4,000 such employees in addition to its 22,000 regular employees. Retired CIA people are often rehired for specific projects as well. They are called independent contractors or annuitants and are usually paid on a daily basis as consultants. All must sign a secrecy agreement. The job of operations officers is to recruit people, known as agents or assets, in foreign countries to spy for the CIA. Typically, 10% to 15% of a station's overall budget goes to pay agents. In the old days, even CIA officers who did not work for the clandestine service were told that, if asked, they should say only that they work for the government. Everyone in Washington knew what that catchphrase meant. When Senator Patrick J. Leahy was elected to the Senate in 1974, he rented a townhouse in McLean, Virginia. Because he did not want his children to put on airs now that their father was a senator, he told them that if anyone asked, they should say their father worked for the U.S. government. Soon his Vermont license plates, Senate 2, arrived in the mail. A few days later, Leahy pulled into the driveway of his home just as a neighbor whose children played with Leahy's children was returning from work. The man came over and looked at the plate, then looked at Leahy. "Boy, you must have one hell of a cover," he said. Nowadays, unless they work undercover, employees of the non-covert directorates may acknowledge they work for the CIA. Undercover operations officers who say they work for a particular agency, such as the Defense Department, are given cover telephone numbers, a briefing on their cover, and a written description of the office they allegedly work for. For example, if they are based in Washington, they may have a cover office that sounds like a real Pentagon unit but does not actually exist. They are given telephone numbers with Pentagon exchanges that are answered at the CIA. There, special operators pretend to be secretaries for the officers and take messages for them. Often, CIA officers who work under government cover are suspected by friends, neighbors, and family of being in the CIA. Whether that is good or bad depends on their neighbors' perceptions of what the CIA does. A 1979 Opinion Research Corporation poll found 62% of all Americans had a favorable opinion of the CIA, while 24% had an unfavorable opinion. 14% had no opinion. Unfavorable opinions were highest among Americans who were college-educated and had higher incomes. Simply not knowing what someone else does can lead to negative reactions. In America, said Robert R. Simmons, a former CIA officer who is now a Connecticut state representative, Americans as a people generally are open about things, especially good things. So something secret is considered something bad. We as a country want to be a city on a hill for all to see. If something is secret, we assume it must be immoral or illegal. CIA officers must also be willing to break the laws of other countries and lie. Violating laws in other countries has never bothered me, David D. Whipple said. Violating their laws is part of our business. Laws in America are violated every day by foreign agents. Therefore, it's important that we collect information in this way. You need clandestine information to go with the other information we collect. It's very necessary for us to understand situations in other countries, the motivation of people, why they are doing it, what their intentions are. That's not easy to collect by open legal means. It's not the whole story, but it is an important ingredient. We don't think of it as living a lie. We think of it as a necessary thing, Whipple said. You have to protect your identity in order to remain effective. It is necessary that others cooperate with you in protecting your identity. It's as if you were a slightly different person. Most people think the Directorate of Operations spies only on hostile targets, such as the former Soviet Union. When the Cold War ended, dozens of commentators began questioning whether the CIA now had any purpose. They did not realize that even at the height of the Cold War, only 10% to 12% of the CIA's budget, excluding development of satellites and other technical systems, was devoted to the Soviet Union and the East Bloc. Even more important, the commentators did not understand a crucial fact about the CIA, that it spies in friendly countries as well as in hostile ones. By agency policy, CIA operations officers may commit espionage in any country of the world. The only exceptions are Great Britain, Australia, and Canada. By CIA thinking, no country is completely friendly. Any country may turn against the U.S. and its interests, or may have elements within it that may turn against the U.S. Thus, France has engaged in stealing American technology from the European branches of such companies as IBM and Texas Instruments, even breaking into hotel rooms of American businessmen in Paris to copy corporate documents. And Israel, one of America's closest allies, recruited Jonathan J. Pollard to obtain an entire roomful of classified documents for the Jewish state. The fact that Iraq, which was supported by the U.S. during its war with Iran, could so quickly threaten American interests by seeking to control more than half the world's supply of oil illustrates why the CIA needs to know what is going on in every country. They, other countries, have their own priorities, their own view of the world, and it often doesn't coincide with ours, a former operations officer said. He quoted Charles de Gaulle, "A state worthy of the name has no friends, only interests." Espionage is illegal basically in most places, a former CIA officer said. So you have to break the law as long as it's not your own law. When I recruit a citizen of that country, he accepts the idea he will break his laws. You're after classified information, the former officer said, or paying off a minister. One thing you don't do, whatever country you're in, is you don't worry about the local laws. If you did that, you basically wouldn't function. He added, almost every country in the world has government people on the payroll of the CIA. Some countries we don't care about. The CIA has to violate the laws of any country, said Thomas Polgar, a former CIA station chief in Saigon, Mexico City, and Buenos Aires, and a former consultant to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Every country has laws against espionage and conspiracy, and our job is to engage in a conspiracy to get secrets which the foreign government wants to protect. You do it through false pretenses. You do it by encouraging treason. In effect, you direct a conspiracy for the purpose of stealing something. If you are an officer under diplomatic cover, you are protected. But the local agent who gets caught is not. The types of crimes committed by CIA officers overseas range from paying a local telephone company employee to hand over long-distance toll records to breaking into an embassy to steal the codes to its communications. The CIA keeps carefully hidden the fact that it spies in friendly countries. In most cases, CIA officers are not caught. On those few occasions when they are caught, the matter is usually disposed of without any publicity or punitive action. The officer may be quietly expelled, and a complaint filed with the State Department. Often, both countries are too embarrassed to do anything. Usually, you have sort of a gentleman's agreement, Polgar said. You do it to us, and we do it to you, and if we have an operational accident, we settle it in a friendly way without anyone getting hurt too badly. When they break the laws of friendly countries, it's always handled in an ad hoc way, a former National Security Council staff member said. Does this name mean something? Yeah. We have reason to believe. Of course, he would be a renegade. We know you wouldn't. Of course not, a former CIA officer said in describing how such an incident would be handled. One of the CIA's goals in friendly countries is to determine if they are developing nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Nearly 40 countries currently have these weapons or are trying to develop them. Once the CIA learns that a country is engaged in such a program, diplomatic or economic pressure can be applied to stop it. The amount of attention paid to a country depends on its importance and the current orientation of its government. African or Scandinavian countries get relatively little attention. France, because of its frequent opposition to U.S. policies, gets more attention. Japan, as a major economic competitor, is a target as well. Israel gets some attention. When James Angleton was in charge of the CIA's counterintelligence program, he also acted as liaison with Israeli intelligence. Spying in Israel was then off-limits, but not anymore. It's okay to recruit Israelis, mostly military officers, meaning paying them, a former operations officer said. That began gingerly after Angleton. The reason is the CIA wants to make sure that Israel is not taking steps that might suck the U.S. into a war. Besides recruiting a key agent with critical information, the greatest success an operations officer can have is penetrating the communications of a country, either by bugging an embassy or obtaining the codes to its communications. Usually these are team efforts, and the plaudits go to many. Soviet successes in penetrating U.S. communications have been well publicized. The bugging of the new and old American embassies in Moscow, and the recruitment of former Navy warrant officer John A. Walker, Jr., who provided the Soviets with codes to classified naval communications. But what of CIA successes? There have been a number of them, most of them secret. Over the years, the CIA has planted bugs in or obtained the codes of a number of Soviet and Soviet bloc embassies, as well as the codes of embassies of other countries, to cite just one category. For all the rivalry among the directorates, when cooperation is really needed, they work well together. The goal was to bug all the embassies of hostile countries, said a former CIA officer who was involved in providing technical assistance for these jobs. You try to get it while it's building. If it is not possible to penetrate an embassy electronically, the next best thing is to recruit someone, the cleaning force or whatever, and have them bring you material from the embassy. A break-in at the embassy would be stupid. If you jimmy the safe and it is discovered, they are alerted. You find someone who has access to it and bring it out each day. That way life goes on. In penetrating these communications, the CIA has learned of diplomatic initiatives before they are broached, the plans of KGB officers, and identities of Americans working for the KGB. Usually a break-in at a local embassy is directed by the local station chief. The Office of Technical Service within the Directorate of Science and Technology supplies the bugging devices or other technical paraphernalia needed to do the job, the tools of the spy trade. For example, the CIA may break into an embassy and photograph the key cards that are used each day to decrypt secret messages. In this case, the Office of Technical Service may supply the cameras, lock pickers, and installers of bugging devices. For all the technical skill required, the most important ingredients for an operation of this kind are resourcefulness and courage, demonstrated when the CIA bugged a Chinese communist mission. Chapter 2. Bikinis. When the Chinese communists and the Soviets each decided to open new missions in Asia, the Directorate of Operations assigned Howard T. Bain to find a way to bug the new offices. Bain is as far removed from the original Ivy League image as one can get. Standing 5 feet 9.5 inches and weighing 172 pounds, Bain has a florid complexion and a raspy voice. His temper is legendary. He chews tobacco and smokes a cigar. Bain attended Georgetown University but flunked out, then went to a junior college to get his grades up. He eventually graduated from George Washington University with a degree in government and international relations. Bain had an exceptional operational mind, intelligence lingo meaning he was a phenomenally good spy. He had intelligence, imagination, common sense, and an ability to foresee problems, solve them, and go on to the next job. He could recognize opportunities when they arose and create them when he needed them. Because of his exploits, he received the CIA's Distinguished Intelligence Medal. Like many officers who joined the CIA during the Korean War, Bain did not give his decision a lot of thought. Bain had been a diver in the Navy, and a CIA recruiter considered this useful background for operating in the war. Bain began in 1950 as a GS-5 filing clerk. The CIA soon sent him to Korea as an operations officer under military cover. There he ran operations aimed at rescuing pilots who had been shot down. Bain served in India and Bangkok and was chief of station in Ghana, Kenya, and Amsterdam. Later he became chief of operations for Africa, special assistant to the CIA's deputy director for operations, and finally chief of counterterrorism. Not every CIA officer is big on bugging. It takes a tremendous amount of time to plan an operation, operations that can be extremely risky and sometimes yield paltry results. In one infamous effort to install a bug in an embassy in Southeast Asia, the CIA got only the sounds of birds chirping. Nor are telephone taps, as opposed to bugs that pick up sounds in rooms, particularly useful. Often the local intelligence service helps the CIA by placing wiretaps. They may give an idea of the daily activity of opposing intelligence officers or which ones are vulnerable to recruitment, but they seldom provide much in the way of secrets. Soviets in particular tend to be not very gabby, although their wives may be. With either bugs or wiretaps, the tapes take time to transcribe. Usually a translator on site gives a rapid assessment of what is being said, but the tapes are sent to Washington for transcription. Yet for all the trouble, if well placed, a bug, known in CIA lingo as an audio operation, an audio op, or a technical penetration, can do wonders to let the CIA know just what the other side is up to. When he was based in Washington, Bain agreed to try to bug the new missions. Since the Soviets and Chinese planned to rent or buy existing buildings, the key would be to determine in advance which properties they might acquire. Bain would then try to bug the buildings before the diplomats moved in. Pretending to be a State Department administrative official looking for space for the U.S. consulate, Bain came up with a list of a dozen buildings the Soviets and Chinese might be interested in. Meanwhile, Bain arranged for a quick plant, a temporary, easily installed bug, to go in the hotel rooms where the Chinese and Soviet officials who were looking for their new quarters would stay. That way, Bain was confident, he would hear them discussing their plans. Bain decided the diplomats would have to stay in one of the 5 major hotels in the city. He and an officer from the Office of Technical Service stayed in each one and waited until maids left their master keys in guests' doors. The 2 CIA men made an impression of the keys and sent them to a CIA Office of Technical Service location in Europe. There, technical officers fabricated a master key for each of the 5 hotels. Using the keys, Bain entered guest rooms and helped himself to lamps from each hotel. He sent the lamps to the office in Europe, which made replicas of the lamps with transmitting devices concealed inside. When the Soviet and Chinese diplomats checked into one of the 5 hotels, Bain exchanged the lamps in their rooms for the bugged replicas. But the effort did not work. Bain could listen to the diplomats' conversations, but the diplomats never discussed which specific site they would like to acquire for the new mission. Meanwhile, Bain had gotten in touch with a local real estate broker whose business included office buildings for diplomats. Bain told him what he wanted and agreed to pay him for the information. Thus, the man became an agent of the CIA. Taking no chances, Bain also decided to bug the house of a KGB officer who had come to town posing as a Pravda correspondent. The man spent most of his time helping the Soviet diplomats look for a suitable location. When the KGB officer was out, a CIA technical officer surreptitiously entered his house and scraped a sample of paint from the wall in his living room. Later, the technical officer returned and installed a transmitter inside a wall. To conceal the sound of drilling, the officer used a silent drill developed by the CIA to mute the sound of drilling with a minute spray of water. The CIA officer connected the listening device to an electrical switch in the wall, so it derived its power from house current. After he installed the device, the officer plastered over the hole in the wall and painted it, matching the old paint perfectly. A pinhole made after the wall was painted conveyed sound to the microphone in the transmitter, which beamed its signal to a nearby listening post. As it turned out, this failed also. To Bane's consternation, the KGB officer usually conducted his business outside his home and said nothing useful while on the air. Before each bug was installed, CIA headquarters approved the plan. Sometimes the CIA decides such an effort is too risky and vetoes the idea. The agency also rules on the level of sophistication for the bugging device. Usually this depends on how important and sensitive the operation is. The more important, the more likely the most advanced device will be approved. With the help of the local real estate agent, who was now on the CIA payroll, Bane decided that the Soviets and Chinese would most likely settle on two buildings. One was a 15-room private home owned by an Asian. The other was an office building next to a golf course. Bane decided that both buildings should be bugged. By this time, the real estate agent Bane had recruited was working with the Chinese and Soviets almost daily to help them find a place. Bane told him he should push the two locations. Meanwhile, Bane arranged to meet the son of the owner of the house by having an intermediary introduce them at a bar. Bane knew that the man liked to go to good restaurants, so he invited him to an evening out with his wife. After they had become regular companions over a period of weeks, the man introduced Bane to his father and mother, the owners of the house. Bane began wining and dining them as well. The CIA approved Bane's proposal to bug the 15-room house, but decided the British should be given the task of bugging the office building. Because a British company owned the building, CIA headquarters figured MI6 would be in a better position to do the job. By now, Bane had recruited the son of the owner of the house as an agent, paying him $1,000 in cash as a start. He was ready to pull off what he hoped would be a major success for the CIA. Bane told the son to tell his father that Bane had a friend who was an Italian movie director. The movie director wanted to rent the place for a week so he could polish a screenplay. He would be bringing a couple of movie stars with him. Bane offered to pay the man's father and mother to move to a hotel for a week. In addition, Bane would pay $5,000 for renting the compound. As the man conveyed the offer to his parents, Bane alerted Office of Technical Service officers in Europe. He sent them photographs of the inside of the house. Seven officers were assigned to the job. The owners of the home agreed to the offer. When they moved out, the CIA people moved in. Bane replaced the padlock on the front gate with a CIA lock. Bane also arranged a code with the real estate agent. If anyone was coming to look at the home, he was to phone and say a prearranged phrase. As it turned out, just before the officers were to leave, the Chinese wanted to visit the home. The agent called Bane and gave the signal. Horrified, Bane told him not to let them in. The Chinese drove up to the home in limousines. The agent tried to open the lock on the gate but found his key would not work. The Chinese would have to come back the next day. After working steadily throughout the week, the CIA officers had outfitted the entire mansion for sound. The transmitters beamed their signals to a listening post 300 yards away. Some of the bugs worked off house current, while others had long-lasting batteries. They could be turned on and off remotely to conserve power and further conceal them. If they heard any indication that a sweep might be in progress, the monitors turned them off. To add a little credibility to the cover story, Bane left the bottoms of two bikinis on the clothesline, evidence that the Italian movie stars had stayed at the home. After the Chinese finally saw the home, they agreed to rent it. Meanwhile, the Soviets took the office building. The British, however, had done a poor job of bugging the building. The bugs did not work, and the effort was a failure. Bane set up a listening post some 150 yards from the Chinese Communist compound. For the next several years, until the Chinese found a new location, the CIA was able to listen to every conversation in the mission, including those in the code room. The information was a treasure trove for the CIA. Unlike the Soviets, the Chinese tended to share overall strategies with their embassies. The CIA was able to learn in advance of the Chinese Communist government's diplomatic overtures and plans, as well as relationships the Chinese had with local officials and with the Soviets. This is the kind of success that thrills CIA operations officers and wins them awards, the kind that only rarely becomes known. It is one reason CIA officers repeat the maxim, "Our failures are publicized, our successes are not." If there is any success that surpasses bugging a sensitive diplomatic post, It is recruiting a high-level official or intelligence officer who is willing to continue to work for his own country. That gives the CIA the benefit of being able to instruct the agent to obtain information according to the CIA's needs. Short of recruiting a high-level official in the Kremlin, nothing could be more sensitive than recruiting a KGB officer in the Soviet embassy in Washington.